You're listening to the Expression Engine Podcast, episode number 63, Progressive Enhancement with EE, which we'll discuss with our special guest, Aaron Gustafson. I'm your host, Leah Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
This episode is sponsored by Mithra 62. CartThrob 2 is officially out of beta. To celebrate the launch, CartThrob is making a discounted package available that pairs CartThrob 2 with popular CartThrob 2 add-on, CT Admin, at an introductory price of $189 for both add-ons. Save $20 for a limited time. Available on CartThrob.com.
The Expression Engine Podcast would also like to thank Pixel and Tonic for being our major sponsor of the year. Hi, Leah. How are you doing?
Pretty good. It's reading week here for universities in Canada, so I have a bit of a teaching break this week, so that gives me a little bit of a breather. How about you?
Oh, I'm not too bad. I got hit with a cold last week, and I'm still recovering, but definitely feeling much better. And I'm really glad to hear you're finally getting a break from your insane schedule.
It's a little nice, yeah.
Before we introduce our guest for today, I'm curious, what is your experience with Progressive Enhancement?
To me, progressive enhancement always meant creating websites that were semantic and had browsers and accessibility in mind. So pretty much proper web standards practices. So to me, progressive enhancement is a reminder that technology and audience is vast and to accommodate for that while still pushing the web forward. What's your take?
To be honest, I've always been confused about progressive enhancement versus graceful degradation. Mm-hmm. But in preparation for our podcast today, I read Aaron's adaptive web design, which clarified things for me. And I'm really excited that I've pretty much been following progressive enhancement techniques for quite a while now, which makes a really great segue to introduce our guest, Aaron Gustafson, who authored adaptive web design. Aaron has over 15 years experience in the field, specializing in the front end. With his wife, Kelly, Aaron runs Easy Designs, a boutique web consultancy in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And when he's not busy running his own business, Aaron is the group manager of the Web Standards Project and an invited expert to the W3C's Open Web Education Alliance. He also serves as technical editor for A List Apart and is a contributing writer for .NET Magazine. Welcome, Aaron.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
We're excited to have you on. Both Leah and I spent the past few days reading your book, and I have to say I quite enjoyed it.
Awesome. Hopefully it didn't take you too long to read.
Well,
it's
no,
a short book.
That was what I was about to say. I'm loving this trend I see in the industry with these much shorter tech books. You can sit down with a cup of coffee on the morning on Sunday and kind of get through it. And I love having the digital format so I can make notes and highlights right in the device.
Yeah, and
cool.
I also like that, you know, honestly, I'm almost old school that I prefer the printed version because even though that it's a short and sweet book, I feel like I can absorb more of the information sitting down with the book, physically feeling the paper and like pausing and making notes with a pen and paper, which sounds so old school for someone who works on the web, but I actually quite prefer that when I'm trying to learn something.
So actually that kind of brings up an interesting point about this because, I mean, when I initially was, you know, thinking about doing the book, obviously digital was a big portion of what I was focused on. And interestingly enough, progressive enhancement works for EPUB as well, which we could talk about if you're interested. But one of the things that we did, because we decided to self-publish the book and we actually, instead of just doing it as another Easy Designs product, we decided to actually create a publishing company so we could eventually do other people's books. One of the things that we did was we actually took a lot of time to look at paper and to look at dimensions and to actually have the printer that we were working with take the papers that we thought we wanted to work with in terms of cover and paper stock and actually bind it together for us to give us a sense of what the weight was going to be of the book and how it was going to feel in your hands, what the tactile experience was going to be. Because to me, I've got a huge library of tech books, mm-hmm. you know, just shelves and shelves and shelves of books. And, you know, a lot of them, I don't know, it seems like the medium doesn't necessarily fit the message.
Mm.
So you'll end up with these really substantial intellectual volumes from Pragmatic Publishers, for instance, or some of the O'Reilly publications, but they're printed on such fine newsprint almost that the book weighs nothing, so it feels inconsequential. So we really kind of took a long time to think about what it was that we were putting into the physical version of the book. And so I guess my question to you, Leah, is how did you feel that the reading experience was in terms of the physicality of the book?
Well, I have to say I loved it, especially because, you know, I actually come from a print design background way, way back when I started my design career. So I appreciate the details of the paper, the weight of the cover stock. And again, there's just something about paper being easy to read. I know there's, you know, e-paper out there, and there's different ways you can have a nicer reading experience with e-books, but all of them are trying to mimic paper. So there's nothing like the original, in my opinion.
It's true. I mean, there's some really neat things that you can do in the ebook arena, such as doing audio and video, like being able to embed video samples and stuff, I think is really helpful for helping people to understand. Yeah, for helping people understand things like accordion interfaces and tab interfaces and stuff. I think video is really awesome for doing that. When you read it, Emily, did you happen to use ReadMill, or did you read it in iBooks, or what was your...
I have a Nook Color, It was in that, and I was able to play the embedded media, which I thought was really cool. That was the first publication I had that had that embedded in it. But I completely relate to Leah's comments and your own investment in the materials of print books, because in the past, print has always been my preference. I too felt I learned best by making notes by hand. I've just slowly been trying to move away from that because I've moved enough times that I can't continue moving these books each time.
I completely understand you. As somebody who had about 3,000 CDs before moved one time, I can understand the cost and the physical toll of having to move massive amounts of books and just media in general. I mean, one of the things that I think is really interesting about the electronic thing, apart from the video, is like I actually was part of kind of a pilot program by ReadMill to do commentary on the book, sort of like a director's commentary. So I did another, you know, one of my many reads through the book on the iPad in ReadMill and highlighted sections and made kind of notes about my notes and notes about various things that I was talking about in the book and, you know, a few jokes and asides and why things ended up in. And that was kind of an interesting experience to me because I've always been a film nerd as well. Mm-hmm. And so when DVDs came out and all of a sudden you had these alternate audio tracks and, you know, sometimes with, you know, people stripped in at the bottom and, like the Ghostbusters DVD is awesome because it's got like the MST3K style people stripped in at the bottom doing the audio commentary. I think one of the Muppet movies did that as well. And being able to kind of bring that to the book world. I mean, both of you have read the book and you've probably read my other stuff as well. So I'm very full of tangents. So there are lots and lots of footnotes in the book because I tend to think tangentially. But it was kind of interesting because in some cases I was doing notes on my footnotes and just kind of taking all of the sides and stuff. And it was kind of neat to have the freedom to do that. So I was pretty excited about that opportunity when they came to me and were asking me to do that for the books. I recommend reading it in ReadMill. It's fun.
I'll have to check that out. And I've noticed that a lot of the comments I've seen on Twitter and such, everyone's really enjoying the book. So let's dive into the topic. The book is called Adaptive Web Design, but you speak about progressive enhancement. What's the difference between adaptive web design and progressive enhancement, or are they just sort of one and the same in your view?
So to me, they're kind of one and the same. I mean, the title adaptive web design wasn't really an attempt to like draw a line in the sand and say, this is what we should call what we do. It was very much an attempt to differentiate the book from a marketing standpoint from the one other progressive enhancement book that's out there, which is Designing with Progressive Enhancement by the folks at Filament Group, which is a great book and is actually one of the books that I recommend in the kind of further reading section in the back of the book. I wanted to differentiate it from that, make sure that there was no ambiguity. And frankly, as a topic, progressive enhancement, not all that sexy of a term, right? we worked through a bunch of different title options trying to think of what it was that really the book was speaking to. What was the promise that the title needed to kind of get across in terms of the nutshell of what the book's about. Adaptive web design was kind of a way to summarize that. And then the subtitle, which is Crafting Rich Experiences with Progressive Enhancement, kind of broadens on that a little bit more. To me, adaptive web design is very much another way of saying progressive enhancement. It's kind of a summation of all of the different techniques that we use. So to me, adaptive web design and progressive enhancement encompasses things like responsive web design, which is more focused on the visual aspects of a website. So flexible, you know, fluid grids, fluid images, those sorts of things, media queries. It takes it a little bit further because adaptive web design and progressive enhancement is about the complete experience. So thinking about it from the point of prose, authoring the actual copy of the website through the semantics that are being applied, through the CSS that is being applied, and then through your JavaScript and eventually your, you know, accessibility enhancements like ARIA and stuff like that that people tend not to think of or tend to think of as very specialized aspects of web design, and really showing how it's a continuum and how we can take advantage of the ways that these different technologies are created and have been drafted to build an ever improving experience for users. So really, you know, kind of crafting that awesome experience and making sure that there aren't technological restrictions to users, that no matter, you know, what device somebody is on, whether it's, you know, an old BlackBerry or, you know, the latest iPad or something like that, that they're going to be able to access your content, be able to complete the necessary task that they've come there to complete or to get the information that they're looking to get from your service.
As I mentioned earlier on, I always had a bit of a confusion between progressive enhancement and graceful degradation. Your book does a good job of sort of clarifying that. Could you do so for our listeners?
Sure. The way that I kind of look at it is that graceful degradation for a long time was the de facto standard. It was, you know, you build to the latest and greatest browsers, and then you did some modicum of testing for older browsers just to make sure that they weren't having horrible errors, but you basically assumed that they were going to have a bad experience. Progressive enhancement, when that idea was first created by Steve Champion, back in, I think it was 2003 at South By, was the first place that he started talking about it. But it kind of turned that idea on its head and said we needed to work from the content out, which at that point, that sort of framing of it makes it seem like progressive enhancement and graceful degradation are at odds, which in some ways they are, but I think it's more of an attitude that's at odds between the graceful degradation camp and the progressive enhancement camp. But in reality, the two are fairly closely linked. Because everything that you build using progressive enhancement, everything that you do to build layer upon layer to create an improved experience and a tailored experience for users of particular devices, that automatically is going to degrade gracefully. So everything that you do with progressive enhancement is taking advantage of graceful degradation or is employing graceful degradation, but not everything that's built following the graceful degradation philosophy is progressive enhancement. So progressive enhancement is kind of a specialized form of graceful degradation where you're actually giving a little bit more consideration to the user and realizing that, you know, we don't know a lot of times what a user is on or how important the user is that is on a particular device. So, you know, we can look at our statistics and say, you know, old BlackBerries, okay, that's 0.001%. But, you know, you don't know if there's, you know, a businessman or woman out there who is using that aging BlackBerry that has, you know, millions of dollars that they want to invest in your product, because it doesn't give you that sort of, you know, the analytics stuff we have does not give us that sort of introspection into our users, although Facebook would probably like to get there at some point. But, you know, that we don't know, and we have to come to grips with the fact that we don't know and we cannot be 100% assured of everything. So why not try and give everybody a great experience? Yes, we can work with the fact that some people are not going to have as, you know, high fidelity of an experience as mm-hmm. other people, but as long as they're having a positive experience and can do what it is that they've come to your website to do, then all's well for me.
I think that's a good point that you make. I think some people get hung up over the fact that progressive enhancement or graceful degradation is trying to give everyone an equal experience, because that is just not possible. Yeah. But you can give everyone a good experience. It's just that the level of how great that experience is different depending on what device they're using, et cetera, and so forth.
Yeah. There were actually two really interesting pieces that I read in the last, I guess it was a couple of weeks, two individuals talking about how progressive enhancement and graceful degradation relate to political philosophies, which I found very fascinating because they were both obviously poli-sci majors, and that was not my area, but I'm a political junkie. But I mean, when I tend to look at graceful degradation and progressive enhancement, it seems like the people who fall into the graceful degradation, or as they are more likely to self-identify now, the hard-boiled design folks, they tend to view progressive enhancement as almost a communistic approach to web design, where you're trying to just take from the rich to give to the poor, make sure everybody has the exact same experience sort of thing. Whereas to me, progressive enhancement is much more of an egalitarian approach, in that we don't know what somebody's experience is. We don't know what somebody's upbringing is. Not everybody has the same advantages, but we still want to make sure that everyone is able to live a productive life or do what it is that they're trying to do, which I think is kind of a better way to look at it, as opposed to trying to make the playing field level for everyone.
Yeah, it reminds me the analogy you have in the book of the peanut M&M.
Right.
Like everyone, the peanut is the center. Everyone gets that goodness, and then you add the layer of chocolate for the people who have the device that supports chocolate. And then you add the candy coating for the people who have the ability to have that. But everyone gets the core.
Yeah. Everyone gets a perfectly valid snack. Well, of course, except for people who have peanut allergies. But, but each of those steps along the way for the American audiences, that's, the peanut, the goober, and the peanut M&M. There are, other brands of chocolate-covered peanuts as well out there, I'm sure, in other countries. Each of those is certainly a valid snack and is a good snack experience, and just some, you could argue, would be better snack experiences. Although some people might really like the peanut. Mm-hmm. So, there are some people who do. I mean, I don't know if you guys saw the Guardian article. The guy was talking about our graphic designers ruining the web.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which was kind of funny. He really likes the peanut. He really wants that just very basic experience with no visual enhancement at all. So, I mean, maybe there is a group of people who like that. I know when Alista Part initially started removing styles from Netscape 4 back in the very, very early days when I first joined there, they actually saw an uptick in the number of people who are using Netscape browsers, because I guess it created a more streamlined experience. I'm not quite sure what the reasoning was, and I'm not sure if they ever found out what the reasoning was, but they actually saw their percentage of usage go up in the browsers that they were no longer delivering styles to, which they were just taking advantage of CSS parsing errors to deliver CSS to modern browsers, but not to Netscape. So
in terms of building these layers, can you sort of, on a sort of superficial level, talk about these layers or these building blocks of progressive enhancement?
Sure. Well, the baseline is definitely the core of your experience, and the web is essentially text and HTTP. That's the absolute lowest level of experience. And anyone who's ever fired up Lynx as a text-based browser will understand that. And that's really your first level of interaction with any website is, if it's got really clear, well-written copy, that's a usability enhancement right there. That's something that's going to help you, sell products or make sure people understand what it is that they're signing up for, if they're signing up for your product. And then HTTP is obviously how we move from page to page within the web of the web, but also how we are able to submit data via forms and stuff like that, how we're able to collect information or allow people to publish information, as in the case of content management systems. So that's kind of the absolute baseline, the zero layer of progressive enhancement. And then upon that, we apply semantics, which are done via HTML. So you have the semantics at different layers of HTML, everything from HTML1 all the way up through HTML5. And the neat thing about the way HTML and the way that CSS are kind of drafted or spec'd out to operate within a browser is that browsers ignore what they don't understand. So that's what allows us to use, say, an HTML5 form control type such as date or email or tell or something like that. And IE6, we'll just ignore that and make it a standard text field. So we can take advantage of these modern approaches to HTML and not have to worry about it in older browsers. Semantics is kind of the enrichment of the content by providing more meaning behind the words. And then we start applying the styles. And my approach to applying style is actually to approach it in terms of facets, which is something that I talk about in the book, beginning with your typographic styles and then moving into your layout styles and then finally your color styles. And I do that to kind of compress the style sheets a little bit because it allows you to take advantage of shorthand within the layout styles, you know, for borders and the like, and then override the border color in your color styles. But that faceted approach works really well because it allows you to expand what it is that you're targeting with CSS. So if you've got your typography styles, obviously that's something that every browser can understand. And then as you begin assigning your layout styles, you can do your base layout styles as kind of your mobile first layouts. So your single column view, your very simple margins and padding so that you're not taking up too much room. And then you can use media queries to adjust the layout moving up in browser size based on how much real estate you have available to you, creating those different interfaces and creating different layouts and such, and then finally tacking on the color styles, and then maybe effects on top of that. But it gives you a clean separation, which makes it easier to maintain your style sheets and to manage growth of a website and addition of new features and such over time. And that's kind of a direction I've gone with my style sheets over the last, I would say, 5 or 6 years. And it's worked really well for us in all the projects that we've done. And it's actually nice how it prepped us to be ready to work in a mobile first way and to be ready for media queries when we finally got media queries. And those style sheets could exist as one big style sheets with lots of media queries within it, or it could be separate style sheets, which might be better if you're targeting specific older devices, older handheld devices, because you can use your media queries in the media attribute of the linked style sheet, for instance, which would stop any phone that doesn't understand media queries or that won't assign those styles because it won't implement that media query. It will ignore those styles and not even download that external style sheet. So you can play around a lot with that to kind of tune the performance of your site and optimize the performance of the site. So that's kind of the CSS layer, and you can apply your styles using those facets. And then there's the JavaScript layer, which to me, the best approach to JavaScript is really kind of an a la carte approach where you're creating individual interactions and making decisions about whether to apply that particular interaction. Let's say converting content into a tabbed interface, for instance. You make the decision as to whether or not to make it a tabbed interface based on whether the necessary JavaScript components are there to do it. And I definitely advocate for having JavaScript create the extra markup or inject the extra styles that those individual components, those interfaces need, because if somebody doesn't have JavaScript support, they're not going to be able to run that widget. So why force that user to download the extra CSS or the extra HTML that would only be required for use in that interface scenario? And then the final layer, and this is kind of debatable as to whether you want to call it a final layer, but the layer of ARIA as accessibility is really HTML semantics, mostly using the role attribute. But then there's a lot of manipulation of that takes place within JavaScript, because ARIA is really useful in complex interfaces like tabbed interfaces and accordions and the like. So I kind of separate it out as kind of a final top layer, but it's really kind of spread throughout the process.
Yeah, I'm glad you clarified that. That was actually one of my questions because of how you had laid it out in the book. I was starting to question. I usually write my ARIA when I'm writing my semantic markup. And I was thinking, gosh, should I be holding off till the end? Because that's the last layer. So it's really just a way of envisioning the layers. It's not really the process.
Yeah, and I think the way that I was approaching the book is that, you know, there are a lot of people, most of the people reading the book have a fairly good understanding of HTML, at least HTML 4.1, right? Maybe not HTML 5 yet, and probably have a decent sense of CSS, maybe terrified of JavaScript, but kind of having ARIA as this top thing, it's something that they're probably aware of, but maybe not all that cognizant of how to use it properly and what the different implications of decisions that you make in terms of scripting or were in terms of style and such, what impact those have on accessibility. So to me, it kind of made sense to not muddy the waters too much in those other chapters and to really address accessibility kind of on its own, even though it really is spread throughout all those other sections.
Mm-hmm. You had mentioned in your discussion about sort of embracing how older browsers will sort of ignore something that they don't support. I think you called it fault tolerance.
Yeah, it's fault tolerance, or in the case of CSS, it's specifically called parsing errors. Browser experiences a parsing error and then decide based on the rules of parsing errors in CSS, it does one of several things in terms of ignoring individual rules and ignoring entire rule sets or entire style sheets, etc.
Now, CSS and HTML are follow that, but what about JavaScript?
JavaScript's the tricky one, mainly because it's a programming language. So the browser needs to understand everything that you're using in order to be able to not throw an error. And if it doesn't understand something, it has to halt execution of the program that you've written, and that's what causes JavaScript errors. So JavaScript can't be fault tolerant for that reason. There have been a couple of different ways that browsers have tried to address allowing you to move forward in terms of what's supported in JavaScript. For a while, you could state a JavaScript version for Firefox as part of the MIME type that you were saying. So text/JavaScript. And I think you would use like a semicolon, and it was like version 1.7 or something like that. I'm forgetting the exact syntax, but it was something to that effect that would allow you to take advantage of newer constructs in JavaScript, and it would interpret the JavaScript using that newer interpretation engine. So you could use things like let statements, which are a more it's kind of like having scoped variables. So you could say let a particular variable equal this within the context of this loop that I'm in, but that variable would not exist outside of the loop. But because let was not a keyword prior to whichever version of JavaScript it was that was drafted, and I think it was 1.6, but it may have been 1.5, any other browser would not know what to do with the let keyword. So that would cause an error in those browsers. So JavaScript, because it is a programming language or a scripting language, it can't follow that kind of same fault-tolerant nature that CSS and JavaScript do, which is why we have to do tests to see whether particular methods that we want to use are available or particular properties are available. And libraries have certainly helped us a lot with that because they kind of abstract away a lot of the browser issues in terms of event models and ways of accessing content and manipulating the DOM and such. So, you know, if you're using jQuery, you don't have to worry about it as much. Although, you know, if you're using jQuery and you're also doing a lot of stuff for mobile, not every mobile browser actually supports jQuery across the board. And I believe jQuery is getting ready to drop support for IE6 if they haven't already. So there are some considerations as far as that stuff goes moving forward. But traditionally, that's where JavaScript libraries have helped out a lot, is by kind of abstracting that stuff and doing the tests to make sure that, you know, things like get element by class name and stuff like that are available to you.
So actually, I was reading through Twitter some conversations about JavaScript being enabled or not enabled, and you made some comments over trying to make sure that people that have devices that don't deal with jQuery still get the proper content. So my question is, then do you just deal with functionality that you know for sure will be done without JavaScript when you're dealing with, you know, multiple platforms and making sure everyone's got the same experience? How do you deal with that?
So, I mean, it really comes down to kind of designing what the progressive enhancement experience is going to be for a particular page or a particular widget. So in the in the case of the tab interface, because I think this is a pretty good example that I walk people through a lot, a tabbed interface requires JavaScript in that, you know, being able to move from section to section within a particular content block with little tabs sticking up.
Yeah.
The way that I approached a widget when I was actually trying to make it a really super accessible, very progressively enhanced version of a tabbed interface is that I started out by looking at the markup, and I realized that essentially if you think about document outlines, which a lot of people don't, but if you think about document outlines, they're naturally created by heading levels.
Yes.
And instead of actually breaking up content by actively putting a div between certain sections of content, if I took a container element and had it classified as tabbed, for instance, I could go through that and look for the first heading level that it encounters. And if that's an H2, I can say, okay, well, based on the fact that an H2 is the first heading level that it's encountered, I know that any other H2s are going to denote sections that are at the same level of as that in the document outline. So I can write my markup and just have that container element, and then within it have my headings, my paragraphs, my lists, my definition lists, whatever the content is for each of the sections, and not have any other additional markup. And then using JavaScript, I can come through and say, okay, here's something classified as tabbed that I want to turn into a tabbed interface. I can run all of my checks to make sure that the various methods that I want to use in order to create this, like, you know, document.getElementById, for instance, or getElementsByClassName or getElementByTagName or something like that, which all browsers pretty much support across the board at this point, but back in the day was not necessarily a given. But I can go through and say, okay, here's a heading level, and then I can split that content based on that H2 throughout and create the markup that I need in order to generate the tab list at the top, as well as the containing blocks for each of the sections of that tabbed interface, and apply all of the different events that I need to handle in terms of when you click on a tab, hiding one tab panel and showing another tab panel, as well as adding the keyboard controls and adding the ARIA roles and other ARIA properties and such in order to make the interface fully accessible. And what you then end up with is that for somebody who comes to that interface with no JavaScript, they just get the content nicely organized with heading levels and all of that sort of stuff. And then somebody who comes to the page that has a more hi-fi browser, they can get that enhanced experience. And a browser that even doesn't support ARIA, for instance, can have that enhanced tabbed interface experience. And then one that has ARIA support on top of that can provide a more accessible tab interface experience. And then the interface itself, the JavaScript, when it runs, in order to build that interface, also injects or triggers the application of styles to build that interface. So all of the styles are maintained separately from the JavaScript, and the JavaScript simply flips a switch. In the example of the tabbed interface that I usually use, I switched it from having a class of tabbed on the containing element to tabbed-on, and all of the styles for the tabbed interface are treed off of that class of tabbed-on. So you don't have styles being applied to build a tabbed interface that won't actually operate because the JavaScript that would make it operate isn't available because there's a JavaScript error or something. So the whole creation of the interface and the application of style to the interface is really governed by the code that actually runs the interface as well. And that's kind of what I mean by having your interfaces, your JavaScript scripts, built in an a la carte fashion where they're maintaining control over kind of their little portion of the experience, but aren't relying on anything else or aren't depending on things to be managed elsewhere or to trigger them from elsewhere, which makes it easier to kind of drop that script into a new site and have it just work as opposed to having to reconfigure it each time.
Thus far, most of what you've talked about is all front end. I'm curious, I know you work with Expression Engine quite a bit. Is there anything with regard to EE that is either a challenge or a benefit to progressive enhancement techniques?
So, I mean, we do a lot of sites in Expression Engine, and it's worked out really well for us in terms of being able to kind of roll with our progressive enhancement needs. We do use, I like to maintain my style sheet separately, and you know, I do want to do server side concatenation of those. So we do that via Expression Engine and then cache out the final file so that we're not having to recombine the CSS, and we maintain those each as templates. Just from a managerial standpoint, that seems to be the easiest route for us. But we also use a lot of the templates as sort of partials for JavaScript to make an AJAX call to pull in content that it might want, or to generate pieces of JSON and such. And Expression Engine's been really good about that as well. one of the new things that we did when we relaunched our blog was to actually take our comment, or not our comment page, but our main article page for each of the blog posts that we do. And in that one template, we account for whether or not there is a segment of the URL that has comments in it, as I think it's the fourth segment. So it's usually the name of the article, and then after that we have slash comments. And we have the template handling it in such a way that if comments is present, it goes ahead and embeds the comment feed into the page. But if comments is not there, it instead injects a link into the page that says, you know, follow this link to view the comments and add your own. And then we're using what's called the Ajax include pattern, where we're using jQuery to go through and actually pull in the comment portion of the page via Ajax after the page has finished loading and inject that into the normal page, replacing the link. What that gets us is it gets users the content that they're coming to read, so the actual page itself, immediately, and then loads in the comments after the fact via Ajax if JavaScript is available. But if JavaScript is not available, we include a link that takes you to the same page again, but with the comment thread embedded in it, and it's an anchor reference down to that. And so that, for us, kind of fills all of our needs in terms of speeding up access to content for, you know, the 99% of users that are just coming to read as opposed to comment and contribute back. But it also covers our bases in terms of JavaScript support, no JavaScript support for being able to comment or to read existing comments. And Expression Engine worked really well for that because we were able to essentially abstract out the comments portion and pull that into the response to the Ajax query to drop in the comments, as well as dropping it into the comment version of the template when that fragment's available or when that segment's available. So that sort of stuff has been really handy in terms of Expression Engine.
You mentioned using include templates, and I know I was looking through your EECI slides, mm-hmm. and you were using a lot of those as examples. Any reason why you prefer using templates for your includes as opposed to something like snippets or low variables or something like that?
I've done low variables before, and we've just started using EE2 more and more. The site that I was showing examples from is actually still 1.6, so snippets didn't exist in it.
Yeah.
So that was the reason that all of those examples don't show snippets. But snippets is something that we're very interested in doing more of, and as we're converting a lot of our 1.6 sites over to we're shifting into using snippets as opposed to using embeds.
Mm-hmm. I was also looking at your slides from EECI, and I noticed that you also referenced just a handful of add-ons that you've used that sort of help a bit with your semantic markup.
Yeah. Let's see. Let me find my slides here. You probably have them in front of you.
Yeah, I'm looking at them right now. I'm kind of pleased. I didn't even know there was an add-on for microformats for sort of mm-hmm. making it easier to generate that. That's something I've always thought about, because it can be a bit of a pain to hand code all of the classes and attributes that are necessary to properly mark something up.
Absolutely. Yeah, that the CI microformats one is one that exists for CodeIgniter, but obviously is then applicable to EE2.
I'm wondering, in terms of working with Expression Engine and doing this progressive enhancement, is there anything with regard to EE control panel itself that sort of fails or doesn't fail with regard to progressive enhancement? Have you ever had a client had to work with a control panel and had a lo-fi browser or lo-fi experience?
We haven't run into that before. It's something that I am interested in kind of figuring out whether it's really necessary. To me, when you start operating in the realm of like the control panel itself, or in the realm of an application like Basecamp, or even Gmail to an extent, when you're operating in an area where you've essentially required somebody to sign up for a service, I think that you can have certain requirements just to mm-hmm. keep yourself from going insane. When 37 Signals decided to drop IE6 support a couple of years back, I didn't really think that was all that bad of a thing for them, because it makes sense from their standpoint, because they are a software as a service, and you know they have to spend their time maintaining their site and such. That said, I don't think that their reliance on JavaScript is necessarily the best route to go, because things happen. People are always saying, well, you know, people have to consciously turn JavaScript off. So, you know, if they don't have JavaScript, that's their problem. Well, not that, you know, that's probably 80% of the people maybe turn JavaScript off, but there's firewalls that block JavaScript. If there is a JavaScript error in the page, it can cause all of the JavaScript execution to stop. I mean, we saw that just recently with the Gawker Media sites, where literally every site on their platform was down because of a JavaScript error. And then there are people who are like, well, you know, my JavaScript is awesome, and you know, I will never have an error in my JavaScript. But if you rely on any third parties that yes. inject JavaScript into the page, I mean, I've gotten bad versions of jQuery from the Google Ajax library that have caused stuff not to work. So if you're relying on anybody but yourself, or you question whether, you know, you might accidentally, you know, type an S where you shouldn't have when you were hitting save on a JavaScript file, it's best to be able to have a site that would be able to continue to operate regardless. So, I mean, I think it makes sense to not 100% rely on JavaScript within things like a control panel, like EE's control panel. But I think that to some extent, it's also okay to have certain requirements for accessing the control panel in terms of browsers that you're willing to support, and to make JavaScript a requirement, but maybe to make sure that things can still operate okay if something happens, you know, with a third-party plugin that all of a sudden breaks the site or breaks the control panel because it injects some bad JavaScript or something. You know, there's so many things that are beyond our control, even though we try and control as much as we can, that I'd rather have stuff that's going to be able to stand up and continue to work rather than have something that's just going to fall apart.
And how do you, I'm curious, you didn't mention it too much in the book. How do you test? What's your approach to it?
So a lot of our testing, you know, we'll test with JavaScript on and JavaScript off. We do most of our development in browsers like Chrome and Firefox. We have several virtual machines that we use for testing various versions of Windows. We do have a Windows machine too, but if we can avoid firing that up, we will. But we've got a couple of XP installs. I had been using VMware for a long time for my virtual machines. I've been slowly migrating over to using VirtualBox because it's free. You know, we've got I think my setup right now is I've got an XP install that has IE8 as the installed version. I'm using IE Tester as a piece of software inside of the virtual machine to test the other versions of IE. I did have the standalone installs of IE6, 7, and 8 that were from Spoon.net before Microsoft asked them to kindly take them down. So we've had them on virtual machines as well. I think I've got that on my Windows 7 VM. And Windows 7, I've got obviously a couple of Firefoxes and Chromes, Safari, Chromium, and then I've got IE9 and IE10 running on that, and then I've got a Windows 8 VM that I'm doing some beta testing of IE10 stuff just to make sure things aren't falling apart too badly, and then lots of other browsers on my Mac. I think I posted a photo to Twitter a couple days ago that showed my browser archive folder, and I think I probably got about, I don't know, 12 versions of Chrome and stuff like that I've kind of collected along the way. Somehow when we were working on a Chrome app that we did about a year and a half, 2 years ago, we had to switch over to the dev channel for Chrome. And somehow in the process of doing that, it botched my Chrome install to the point where it won't automatically update, which has been great because it allows me to have the old version of Chrome and download a new version of Chrome and have them each be standalone. So that's actually been kind of a blessing. So each time a new version of Chrome comes out, I obviously have to go download it, but it's nice because I can actually test to see whether things are regression bugs, for instance. So Chrome, because of their frequent updates, they sometimes introduce bugs that didn't exist in prior versions. Like I've been revisiting this Chrome app that we did to actually make it work for Firefox and for Opera and for Internet Explorer. And we noticed in the latest version of Chrome, in Chrome 17, it drops out background images at weird times. It wasn't doing it in Chrome 16 or before. And when we put this app out, I think it was originally like Chrome 9 or something. It's something that they've introduced as a new bug and hopefully will be addressed, but it still seems to be in Chrome 19, which is the current beta release or dev release. I'm not sure which channel that one's on. But anyway, so it's helpful to be able to have those different versions, because then we can actually look at a site. If a client comes to us and says, hey, this isn't working now, we can say, okay, this is something that we will fix, or this is something that is a problem that the browser just caused, and they will hopefully pick it up in their next release mm-hmm. that will be just transparently done behind the scenes for their users if it's Chrome.
So then so you mentioned all the browsers and items, but I don't think I caught when you actually start looking at the different browsers. Like, when do you finish the site in the main browser, like the latest browser that you're targeting, and then look at each browser afterward? Or do you test iteratively? Like, you know, after, you know, okay, part one
after
is done.
After a certain page is done,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
So most of what we do depends on the project, really, because there are some projects where people come to us and they only want us to build a prototype, or they want us to only build for one particular thing. As in the case of this Chrome app, we were building it mainly looking at Chrome and Safari, because those were the browsers that the client was specifically targeting because they were building a Chrome app. But in most cases, when we're kind of doing our full process, we build our templates as static HTML files and CSS and such. After we build the templates initially, then we do our browser testing. And while that browser testing is going on, we usually do our CMS integration or whatever it is that we need to do in terms of the underpinnings of the project from a programmatic standpoint. And then we do kind of a final sweep of testing through all the browsers again once the complete product is done. So the testing usually happens at two different points, but it's not like okay. We keep all the browsers open while we're building templates. We build to the latest templates, but our process of building and using the faceted design approach to CSS and, you know, focusing on good markup and the approach that we've developed over the years that we've been working on the web makes it so that in most cases the progressive enhancement needs are already met as we're building, and we don't end up having that many problems in the older browsers. At this point, I think when we do go back to do, you know, one-off fixes for IE7 or 6 or what have you, that maybe we end up with 10, you know, 5 or 10 rule sets, mainly to adjust a few minor padding issues or something like that. But not really all that much anymore.
Before we close the conversation, I want to take a slight turn from the conversation on progressive enhancement and ask you, you mentioned in your book about this tendency we as developers have to sort of eagerly embrace the shiny new tools that come out and kind of forget, you know, what other people might still be using. I'm just curious, especially considering the current vendor prefix predicament we find ourselves in, what are your thoughts on what our responsibilities as developers are to ourselves and also to the clients and employers who are pushing for the shiny tools?
I mean, I'm all for shiny things, but I think it really, you know, we need to think about what the implications of each decision that we make have on the user experience. And are we doing this just so that we can show off to our peers and say, hey, check out this awesome thing that I made? You know, don't you wish you made it? Or are we doing something that's kind of a nice enhancement that, so, you know, we just launched a poster contest called the I Love Adaptive Web Design Poster Contest that Farla Peters and Easy Readers, my publishing company, are doing. And in the header banner section, there's the heart symbol for the I Love Adaptive Web Design. And as an enhancement, I decided, hey, why not make the heart beat, right? Use some CSS animation stuff. And so I did that, but I didn't do it just as hyphen WebKit, you know, hyphen keyframes and do the animation that way. But I actually figured it out for each of the browsers and applied the styles in such a way that they would actually work for the different browsers that support the animations. And in some cases, thinking about, you know, the future versions of browsers. So I don't remember if IE10 actually has the animation stuff working yet or not in the versions they've got out. But, you know, anticipating that they will probably have a prefixed version in IE at some point before the final spec for animation is released. So putting that in there in addition to the Moz and Opera prefixes and obviously the WebKit prefixes and then the standard version of what it's going to be in the future. I think that's just a smart way to go because, you know, even though this page may not necessarily be a high traffic page when IE10 hits the mainstream market, if somebody does happen to go to it in that browser, I can give them that nice little enhancement, that nice little, you know, visual flourish. But I think as a web professional community, we need to think about what are the reasons behind doing it? What are the necessities of having that particular feature for all browsers? Is it okay if a browser doesn't get that animation? Yes. You know, that's just a visual flourish on the page. Same thing goes for things like, you know, drop shadows or inset shadows or rotation and stuff like that. We shouldn't require that our page rely on those techniques, which are not always guaranteed, or in some cases are not, do not perform well in terms of animating lots of items on a page that are rotating and so on and so forth via CSS. Some browsers just slow to a crawl with that, which is something that we encountered with our work on the Chrome app that we were doing when we started porting that to other browsers. But to actually, you know, brush up on what browsers support which technologies and which techniques and be aware of maybe the peculiarities of those. To give an example of that, I mean, for a long time, I don't even know if they've actually made it work yet or not, but you're allowed to put a space and an nth child selector inside the parentheses on either side of the 2n plus 1 or whatever. You can have spaces in there, but if you had spaces in there, at least back at, I think it was Safari 4, Safari wouldn't understand that selector, and so it would ignore the entire rule set. So there are things like that and things like, you know, Mozilla's weird interpretation of individual border radii back when they used to have border radius top left with no hyphen between it and things like that. So you have to kind of know what the peculiarities are of the implementations. We can't be lazy in our approach mm-hmm. to doing this stuff. If you want to work with the latest fads in CSS and in web design, you need to make sure that you are professional about how you're doing it, that you're not just, you know, taking a non-focused approach to doing that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's all the time we have for today. Thank you, Aaron, for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it was great.
It's been fun talking to you.
It was great. In case our listeners do want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
So my company is Easy Designs, easy-designs.net. They can read more about my book at adaptivewebdesign.info. It's all one word. Or easy-readers.net is the publishing company. And they can follow me on Twitter. I'm Aaron Gustafson, all one word. And I'm happy to answer people's questions via Twitter. I'm on there pretty frequently. So
cool. So now we'd like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Mithra 62 and Pixel and Tonic.
We would also like to thank our partners, Ellis Lab, Engine Hosting, and Devotee.
Also, thanks to our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about the podcast, make sure you follow us on Twitter at EE Podcast or visit our website, ee-podcast.com.
And don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll be discussing selling Expression Engine. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, ee-podcast.com/schedule for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for the Expression Engine podcast. See you next time.
Cheers.